the Twitter posting of either, there's two types of Twitter posters today. Meme coins are going to revolutionize society. Meme coins are, you know, the new culture coin, and they're the new, they represent the new community in a digital first world. And they're trying to basically play up what these meme coins are. Then there's the other side. Meme coins are the stupidest thing. We're wasting brain power and energy. And they're neither. They're just something that people are trading. And like, stop fucking pontificating on what these things are. I'm sick of all these meme coin hot takes. If you are an Empire listener, hopefully you've played around on chain. And if you have done that, you know that transferring assets across different chains is a pain, to put it nicely. That is why we are incredibly excited to have the Wormhole Foundation as a partner of the Empire podcast, stewards of the Wormhole protocol, supporting over 30 different blockchains and 6 different runtimes. Stay tuned later in the show. We have a cool thing that you can claim, which is a Wormhole NFT just for Empire listeners. This episode is brought to you by Monad, which has not only the highest performance EVM L1 architecture ever built, but also the wildest and craziest community in crypto. Monad's internal devnet is live and public testnet comes out soon. So make sure you join the Monad community today at discord.gg/Monad. M-O-N-A-D, Monad. All right, everyone. What's going on? We got two tired souls coming in. Santu, what's happening, man?
Not much, man. Just another day. A lot to talk about. A lot of big day today, right? The wormhole airdrop. So
I honestly have not looked. I'm kind of over these airdrops. I'm a little
shout out to Murd. He had a great tweet about it. He's like, yeah, being a maxi doesn't pay because I never bridged from Ethereum to Solana. I never used the bridge because I've always been Solana native, so I didn't get the airdrop. I'm like, that checks out.
Yeah, so it's trading at a little 14. I feel like everything's trading in this range. A $14 billion, $14 billion slid a little bit since it launched. It launched at what, 1.5? It's down to 140, or no, 130. It launched at, went up to 150, slid to 140. Total fully diluted valuations at $14 billion.
Yeah, slid a bit. It was trading in what is it, Avo, secondary market, like
17.
It was between 17 and 20. So it was, these things are fairly accurate. Actually, have become fairly accurate. Which is pretty good indicator, actually.
So Athena also launched an airdrop.
Yes.
They launched their token this week, and it's trading at a $2 billion valuation. What do you think is the logic and the decision?
Fully diluted. I think fully diluted is much higher than that. It'll be 12.
No, $2 billion.
Is it okay?
On CoinGecko, it is.
Hold on.
Right. Maybe, oh no, I'm looking.
I think maybe I'm hallucinating.
I think I'm looking at the stablecoin. Yeah, I'm looking at the stablecoin. 16 billion FTV. Yes. Bananas. It's bananas. So it's higher than Wormhole. That's wild.
Yeah, people are young. You know, people are chasing that yield. We can unpack all that. But listen, folks, just a word of advice here. When you see these things, just pay attention to fully diluted. Pay attention to unlock schedules. There's good websites out there that will tell you when investors are unlocking. You never want to, you know, just for a second there, think about the relative value of something that is $17 billion. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, things can go to much higher and irrational. But, you know, I'm an early stage investor and I look at that and I'm always cautious.
Yeah.
I much rather let these next couple, like whenever there's airdrops, I let kind of the market kind of like work its way through it for a couple of weeks as people claim, sell. There's a lot of chaos going on with market makers. So I'd rather just kind of be on the sidelines.
Yeah, I mean, you compare something like, so Athena, $16 billion, Wormhole, $14 billion. Then you compare that to something like Arbitrum,
Athena, which is $14.5 billion. Arbitrum. Higher than Arbitrum, higher than Uniswap, higher than Aave, higher than Maker.
Yeah. Yeah. People can make, so we jumped right in. You got the hat on today. Is that
it's freezing my room.
Are we with hat for a reason or?
I love hats. Someone out there needs to get me this goddamn pink hat. Ansem, if you listen to this, I know you have a guy. Send me that guy because I want it. I just want it. So this is the closest thing.
I'm so over this. Okay, so I know.
Wait a minute. What?
I'm so over the Twitter posting of either. There's two types of Twitter posters today. Meme coins are going to revolutionize society. Meme coins are, you know, the new culture coin, and they're the new, they represent the new community in a digital first world. And they're trying to basically play up what these meme coins are. Then there's the other side. Meme coins are the stupidest thing. We're wasting brain power and energy, and they're neither. They're just something that people are trading. And like, stop fucking pontificating on what these things are. Yeah. I'm sick of all these meme coin hot takes. Just let the people trade.
I've taken a more simplistic approach to not just meme coins, but just stuff in general. Ultimately, markets are the arbiter of truth. No one really cares what you think. The market just rules. And so people are finding, look, it's pretty interesting. I shared this with you before the pod. Binance has done more volume. I think it was yesterday. Binance has done more volume on WIF than on Bitcoin. Now, I'm not making any conclusions. It's just an interesting data point. Coinbase, I believe, when it listed Bonk, it had multiple days where it just broke all kinds of records. And, you know, I'm a very laissez-faire markets person. You know, I think if people are against meme coins, oftentimes, like, you get into these discussions, right? People are like, oh, I hate crypto, or I hate meme coins. I'm like, do you also hate Las Vegas? Do you also hate sports betting, entertainment? And they're like, no, that's totally different. I'm like, is it? And so that's always my line of defense. Historically, I've tried to rationalize a lot of things, and I just like to just flip it to something that is very closely related to what they're attacking. Because oftentimes people just attack stuff that really contradicts another thing that they like. And so that's where you corner them and you're like, all right, explain your flawed logic. So I've done that and just saved a lot of time and energy.
Yeah. There's this interesting chart I saw Luke Martin post on Twitter, which is, and then I'm going to allocate zero more time to this podcast to these meme coins. But there's this interesting point that Luke Martin posted about state lotteries, which is lottery ticket sales are at a record high. So if someone's listening to the podcast, not watching on YouTube, this chart is up and to the right, up only. It just passed 100 billion in state lottery tickets in 2023. You compare that to 2010, we were around, it looks like we're around like 55 billion. Now it looks like we're about, what is this chart? 105 billion. So that's, you know, we've doubled state lottery tickets. And this is just, I mean, you see it on the subway. I was on the New York subway today, and there's just advertisements everywhere to go buy lottery tickets.
Lottery tickets, like, probabilistically, the odds of you winning there are extremely low. Casinos too. The house always has a marginal edge. So if you continue to play in an infinite sequence, you will lose all of your money.
Oh, you haven't been at a craps table with me. I got the edge. I got the edge at the craps table.
You bet on red. Just drop it.
No, that's roulette. That's roulette.
Oh, roulette. Yeah. Listen. Yeah. This all tells you how much I spend in a casino. I live in a casino 24/7, 365. I don't need to go to Vegas. But the thing I'll say about meme coins in this discussion, I think it's a healthy discussion to have amongst just the community. And it also tells you a lot about the type of person, right? But one thing that I will say in this discussion around airdrops and projects trading at fully diluted, meme coins are kind of more simplistic versions of, like, you know, projects. I'm not saying that they have a roadmap, they have utility. No, they're just memes, right? But you don't have this, like, very low, extremely low float, high FTV dynamic, which has historically been quite hurtful. Or not hurtful, but it's just, it's just a thing, right?
Can you? I hear a lot of people say that. Can you, for people who maybe don't know that, can you explain why that's harmful?
Not all meme coins are created equal. For the most part, you look at like WIF, you look at some other meme coins. The entire supply has been distributed. It's trading constantly.
Inverse, though. What's the? It's a commonly used phrase. All right, the market cap is this, but the FDV is this. That's a harmful dynamic that has played out. Why is that harmful or problematic?
I'll retract the harmful part because, again, it's difficult. But
markets are markets.
Yeah, exactly. The tricky part is when you a project, take Athena because we're talking about it, or Wormhole. They have a billion tokens. Total tokens is going to be a billion. They don't issue that all at once. Most projects don't do that. They have because they have an emission schedule. They have certain tokenomics that, you know, like Bitcoin, you're emitting these tokens based on whatever liquidity mining incentives, certain other metrics. Right? Token is the way you acquire customers, the way you attract attention. You do that over time, right? For Athena, it's you want to incentivize people to deposit and earn a yield. The way they're capturing that yield in part is by these rewards that are emitted in the native token. And so they're not going to issue that all at once. So you have this dynamic, right, where the project might be at best airdrops like 5% initially, maybe 10%, maybe 20%. But it's as a percentage of the total token supply, it's quite low. And so when you think about price discovery, it's going to take a lot of time for the market to really come to terms. And usually, for instance, Arbitrum just had their first big unlock for investors last month. So there was some selling. It was trading at two, dipped all the way to $1.64. It's trading at $1.45. Ahead of that, you saw some activity. And even with the price decline, there's a lot of noise there because the markets have been choppy, whatever. But on a market cap basis, circulating market cap, Arbitrum actually, even with the price decline, it's actually trading at all-time high market cap-wise because there's just more tokens out in circulation. General rule of thumb. More tokens in circulation, better price discovery. Small percentage of tokens in circulation, tricky price discovery for the most part. Unless, of course, you can point to Evo if there's a healthy secondary market, like Second Lane or some of these brokers, right, that they're facilitating transactions, then you may have a better approximation of how these things are trading. But it's tricky, I think. Like I'd much rather prefer, seeing a project where you have much more percentage of the total token supply out in the wild, trading hands actively, or you just have a better sense of the true value of that market cap of that project.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. So we had three topics on the dock for today. There's these like L2s, L3s. Then there's meme, like just meme coin stuff that we just talked about. And then there's airdrops. And I think if you try to, basically the through line of all of these things is it's a fight for attention. There's just a violent fight for attention right now. If you're a builder and the, like what are airdrops? If you look at like what airdrops are on your, as a line item, basically on your P&L, it's a marketing expense,
yeah.
If you look at meme coin, like so I saw DJ
stock-based compensation, or, giving that to employees. Yeah.
Sure. SBC and it's a way to get it's a marketing expense and a way to get or whatever you want to call it, but it's a way to get attention. Meme coins, what are they? If you're a project, like I saw DGen is now launching an L3 or something or another. Like I think actually you're going to see it, or I think you could say Backpack and Mad Lads. Like they launched as not a meme coin but an NFT. And then they start building things on top of it. It's just a way to get attention. L3s and L2s, like why does I actually want to have this bigger conversation about L3s and L2s, but like at this point, a lot of the technology is commoditized. Why does someone choose to build on Blast versus Base versus Binance Smart Chain versus Arbitrum versus Solana? All the tech's going to get commoditized. It's user acquisition. It's user acquisition and attention. And that's the game that everyone's fighting right now. So maybe we can talk about You know, talk about L3s. You sent me this message this week and you said, I don't have much of an opinion on L3s other than they are just not good. So maybe I'd ask you to, that's obviously a pithy Telegram message, but I'd love for you to just like hear your take on L3s.
Folks, if you're going to DM Yano, just remember he works for a media company and he's going to always air laundry.
You didn't say off the record. You didn't say off the record. Actually, let me tee up the record. I'll tee up the conversation on L3s actually first, yeah, maybe, which is that. Yeah. So there's the L1, which is Ethereum, obviously. Then all these L2s launch, Optimism, Arbitrum, Starkware, things like that. There was a post in September of 2022 by Vitalik. He said, what kind of layer threes make sense? And I think this kind of woke a lot of people up to this idea that, hey, look, eventually there's going to be L3s and then maybe L4s. And there's actually this, maybe I'll pull up this diagram from this piece here. Let's see if I can. So for anyone who's watching on YouTube can see this. So you've got the L1, right? You've got Ethereum right here. Then you've got Starknet. Then the L3 might be StarkX, which is Rollup, or StarkX the Validiums, app-specific Starknet, a different one, privacy Starknet, and then you've got the L4s, right? So if you read this post back from the end of 2022 that Vitalik made, he said the conclusion here is that kind of L3s are good for three things. L2 is for scaling. L3 is for customized functionability. Functionality. For example, privacy, right? That's one thing. L2 is for general purpose scaling. L3 is for customized scaling. And then the third bucket was L2 is for trustless scaling like rollups. L3 is for weakly trusted scaling validiums. And now we're a year and a half later, and you're starting to finally see these L3s come to the market, right? Folks are building L3s. I think DGEN launched an L3, which originally started as a meme coin, launched an L3 on Base. You're seeing Arbitrum Stylus. You're seeing Optimism. You're seeing people build these L3s. I'd be curious to get your take on just what you think of these L3s in general.
Again, I'm not sophisticated on this topic. I haven't followed it other than it just gives me I'm sure it's one of those topics that I have like tabs open that I don't want to dive into because it's just, I'm not very incentivized. It's just like, it feels painful. I'll punt it over to you because I think you may have a more formed opinion here. Like for instance, Arbitrum Stylus, why, what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is, you know, if people want to use generalized Arbitrum tech and layer on layer on something more specific, as Vitalik is saying, why can't you do that as a L2? The same way that Base is using the OP stack as an L2. Why do you need what's the rationale for an L3? Or is, like, it's sort of unclear to me.
Here's my thesis on what's happening is everyone's basically saying, I want the security from Ethereum. So I'm going to use the L1 for security. I'm going to use the L2 for scalability. And then I'm going to use the L3 for control. And I think that's kind of the narrative. And that's what's playing out if you talk to some folks who are doing this. I think really what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot of experimentation at the L3 level or L3 layer. And then you're going to see a lot of again, I really think this L2 tech will ultimately be commoditized. I don't know if Arbitrum's winning or Optimism's winning or Polygon's winning or Scroll has ZK stuff. It's all going to be commoditized in my mind. And the only two reasons that someone will pick something is the brand and the user acquisition that comes from building on it. So maybe Blast is for more degen. Yeah, go ahead.
But Blast is an L2. Base, as we think of it today, is described as an L2. You can bridge directly from an L1 to Base. Maybe that's the simple definition of an L2. Bridging from an L1 to an L2. So Base is a fork or using the OP stack. Optimism is also an L2. Base, Optimism, there's some deal there where Optimism granted a lot of the tokens to Coinbase, who then decided in their RFP assessing which L2 tech to use, whether Arbitrum or Optimism stack, they decided to use Optimism. And it was heavily incentivized, is my understanding. They're an L2, though. Base is an L2. Could Base be like in that decision tree of Coinbase thinking that they're going to build something in Ethereum? Say that there's the next Coinbase, another exchange. They want to go through the same decision-making process as Coinbase did. Are they going to build an L2 or an L3? Like, why would you build an L3? Where you can build an L2 using the stack of Arbitrum or Optimism. Like, that's where I'm like, why are you stacking and have more dependencies in an L2 where you can just have the direct line of into an L1? It just seems like there's going to be more friction introduced if you have to make, unless, again, this is where I'm dumb on this, and I'm not familiar. If you can hop directly from an L1 to an L3, okay, maybe, but it just feels unnecessary.
Yeah, you got two dumb L3 guys here. So let's pontificate for a second, just knowing that neither of us are deep in this right now. I think the key word here is bridge. I think when I think about like an L, here's the if I'm an L2, here's my vision. I'm trying to get as many folks to basically build these L3s on top of me. And I think an L3 in a sense is like, it is cheaper than running, cheaper and maybe more secure than running all of these bridges. Right. So it's maybe better to then deploy, like the L2 essentially just becomes a bridge. Like I think the L2 in this sense, like let's use Arbitrum, let's use actual things. Let's say there's Ethereum for security. Then all these L3s want to, then all these like apps, all these applications want to get built. And then if you believe in the app chain thesis, you say, okay, well then all these apps are going to build their own chains.
Yeah, man. But like, I get it. But like, if you're like Stepin, for instance, or a game, fork the OP stack and build your L2. Heck, why even stop there? Build your own L1. That's going to happen too. So it just feels like if you go back to when Ethereum got started, there was the Ethereum killers. The incentive for developers to build their own chain was superior to build on Ethereum because they can launch their own L1, they can have more autonomy, and they could capture way more value. Look at all the professor coins, Thunder Chain and Avalanche. And like the incentive for a developer was very strong to build an L1. If we believe that to be true, even in today's environment, why, again, the question is, and I'm not sophisticated, I'm just posing the question, why would a project that is worth their salt, that has a good product that has, that is capturing attention, why would they build an L3? Why not build an L2 directly? It seems like an L3 just introducing more lock-in dependency to one particular L2 when the current state of L2 to L2s and L2s to L1s is very fragmented. We're not there yet where bridging easily is becoming a challenge. The cost point of an L3, I think, is a mute one because you can use modularity again to use Celestia or like, so like it's not, I don't buy this argument that an L3 is cheaper. I also don't buy the argument that an L3, like, why would you lock yourself into a particular ecosystem like Optimism or Arbitrum? Okay, maybe you believe that bridges across L2s is going to be great. This goes back to the heart of, you want to ask me why I've lost conviction, lost interest in Ethereum, even though, mind you, I've invested in a lot of L2s because I have a very strong incentive for Ethereum scalability to run out of work. I just don't think it's as elegant. What matters most here is from a user's perspective. I don't think it's as elegant, as clean, as integrated chain like Solana or Aptos or some of the other ones. Just not. Maybe the other part of my brain says, you're being too critical. Over time, the tech will be commoditized and abstracted away where it's just going to be very easy to work your way around these chains. So this argument doesn't kind of really matter. If the tech is really good, you can hop around and someone's going to figure that out for you. But we're in a state where we have to think about this. So I'll go back to my main question that I hope someone can answer out there. If you're a listener, please jump in into the discussion. If you're a really good builder, a project, an application, why would you build your L3 and be sub and have, to me, sounds like more dependencies and lock-in? Whereas you can build your own L2, like Base did using the OP stack, or heck, even build your own L1.
Here's the thesis, which is that if you go fork the OP stack, you're then trying to create your own ecosystem of liquidity over here. But if you just go build on Arbitrum, or you go build on top of Optimism, let's say you become an L3 on top of Optimism, you now have like interconnectedness of liquidity with everything else on Optimism. But if you fork it, I think so. Right?
Like, what is the distinction between the interconnectedness horizontally versus vertically?
I really don't know, vertical
versus not horizontally. Like,
I mean, if you fork, like, let's say you fork, let's say you build on the, what's OP's thing? OP superchain or whatever it's called. Like, and you go build your own L2. You now are not, I really don't know. But I think you're not connected to like the look, you're kind of fragmenting the liquidity there. Whereas if you build an L3 on top of Optimism, maybe it's that you get interconnectedness with everyone building on Optimism. I'm out of my depths. Here's a cynical take on this is that L3s are only exist because L2s don't know what their business model is. And L2s need basically L3s are a marketing thing created by the L2s because they didn't have a good business model and they needed more value accrual to the L2. And so if you look at like why L3s maybe exist, maybe it's a marketing thing that the L2s have kind of pushed on to crypto Twitter and the industry to drive more value landing on the L2 instead of on the L1. And that is
really on the app instead of the L2. Like what you're saying is like, if you're a good app, mind you, in Base, there's a lot of apps on Arbitrum, DeFi ecosystems and all of them. Is like a perp protocol going to build their own L3? I don't see it.
What is the impact? Okay, let's say all these L3s. I can't wait for just us to get shredded on Twitter and YouTube from this conversation.
I'd love to be shredded because I'm only posing questions.
Yeah. Let me again, I'm just going to try to play the cynical person here. If all, let's say, fast forward, let's say all these L3s actually take off. More and more of the fees on Ethereum. Wait, I'm trying to think this out. Ethereum is going to start earning less and less and less fees. And if it's earning less and less and less fees, and the fees are kind of like landing on the L2 instead of landing back at the L1, perhaps the value of ETH drops. And then it kind of creates this really negative feedback loop where like maybe people start to get spooked, the validators no longer are willing to hold ETH and they're no longer willing to secure the network, and you lose this idea of like, oh, maybe the Ethereum security is not the end all be all. So I think while these L3s are maybe a good idea for the L2s in the short run, long term, I think it's easy to be cynical on it.
I think it's an excellent point. At what point? I think that time and time again, we hear this, like users and liquidity is on Ethereum, EVM. I get it. Today is true. You're not building for the state of the world today. You're building for state of the future. If you're a really good product, which we haven't really seen, you're going to attract a lot of users and liquidity directly to your app. You control that. You control that user. Why not go build your own L1? We're like talking about like micro usage right now. In the grand scheme of things, the only reason we're all here is because we believe that this actually becomes like an incredible extension of the internet. We haven't really seen that yet, but somehow we're like caught into these debates of scalability and saying that Ethereum's like the winner or like the dominant chain. Certainly, it's starting to be like contested very easily in terms of usage, in terms of fees. Solana, for instance, has had multiple days now where the fees there, has been higher than Ethereum. So your question is a really good one, which is where does, if an L3, an L4, an L5, an L27, whatever, at what point does, if the value capture sits on the L2 or higher up the stack, at what point is it just economically and more importantly, like the security starts to kind of fall apart and you'd rather build your own L1 because you become like the value's there. So you just drop into an L1, right? My simple thesis for something like Solana is that like, and Mert, credit to Mert, because he actually was the first one to come up with this. He said, like, the scalability trilemma, which we've always go back to, it says, you know, security, decentralization, what is it? Security decentralization and scalability, I believe. That's one of those things. I think it's those three. And you can like, you know, do some trade-offs around the continuum. But it's like, simplistically today, the way I think about it is the most secure chain will be the one that has the most killer products, because that creates more fees. Assuming that the fee capture is worked out, not every chain is figured out. By the way, no chain is perfect in terms of fee markets. They're all kind of trying to like optimize it. Ethereum has done it with the EIP-1559, which I think is really novel. I think Solana will have to do that. It's figuring that out. Other chains will probably have to do that as well. But like, it's not a bad problem to have. Like, if you have a lot of demand and usage, then that creates a robust fee market, right? That creates more security because the validators you incentivize validators naturally to come to your chain, earn fees, and then but it begins and ends with you have to have killer applications. You have to have performance. And that means user experience today is far superior in Solana, I think. Base is not bad. Like, these L2s are not bad. I don't want to come across as negatively critical of L2s, but I just think that the integrated design today is more elegant and more clean for the user as opposed to having to bridge across. Cosmos has this problem too, not just Ethereum. I think users naturally always gravitate to where the easiest, they don't have to think about this stuff, right? Maybe in 6 months or a year, like, this connectivity across L2s, L3s, L27s, like, is like totally abstracted away. It's super clean. Then that I'll revisit my thesis. But let me ask you a question. Would you agree or disagree that it's just a cleaner experience in Solana? You don't have to think about bridging across Base and Arbitrum and
I think so right now, but like, Solana is one cycle behind ETH, and ultimately there's going to have to be Solana L2s. Like, if you talk to a lot of you don't think so?
We had this discussion in London. I think the drip, was it
Vibu or whatever?
Vibu and the Tensor. Like, I think there's been discussion around it. I tweeted about it. I think that thread has really good, healthy debate. So we should link
to that. I didn't see that. All right.
Yeah, I tweeted about it right after DAS. I don't think it solves ultimately much. Maybe for drip, but I came away after reading all the comments. Austin, for instance, commented in there. I thought that was one of the best responses there. So if we can pull it up or just link to it. But I agree with his take, which is they're not solving the current issue and bottleneck constraints that Solana has right now. When I say bottleneck, it's sort of like the fees. The value, Tushar and the multicoin guys, like, again, come out, and I actually do agree with their take, and they've been saying it for years. You value an L1 based on the MEV capture. MEV capture in Solana is going to continue to be actually more and more interesting and robust. You're already seeing that with Jito. In Ethereum, where's the MEV going to be captured? Like, centralized sequencers are actually capturing a lot.
You value an L1 based on all the MEV capture. I think that's trying to, I disagree with that. I think that's trying to put some like TradFi framework, basically, of like valuation on top of an L1. Like, how do ETH or SOL or whatever, like, they're valued the same way that you value like grain or gold or oil. They're just commodities. Like, SOL is just a commodity. So any like ETH is, in at least in my mind, is just a commodity. So any, like, if you look at how people, you know, people don't talk about soybeans or whatever. Like, they're not, or oil. They're not like, oh, look at the P&L of oil today. They're like, oh, there's a supply shock happening to oil today. OPEC cut the thing, or there's something happening in China.
But the oil markets, for instance, there is nuance where the value capture happens. EMP, like expiration, has been really challenged. A lot of people go bankrupt there because you have to be really right. But like, the refinery process, the refinement of crude into like higher, like, you know, that's where most of the value is captured. So you think holistically of the oil markets, not just oil itself. is what I'm saying. Like the whole ecosystem, like the whole energy, like oil and gas industry, and think about like where's value being created, like where's the highest margin stuff. Anyways, it's like a loose analogy. I don't want to go into it. I don't know. I'll just go back to, I would love to better understand, and hopefully someone can jump in here and just make the case of the need for an L3 in the context of Base use the OP stack, built their own L2. And can someone also just tell me why Base at some point won't even launch their own L1?
Yeah, we have, I want to get Stephen from Arbitrum's take on this. They have Arbitrum's, I think it's Stylus. And I think, and the reason I want to pick on him is I think they have the most capital deployed on Arbitrum right now. I'm pretty sure, and the most number of apps that have built on Arbitrum. I'm pretty sure about that. In terms of like all the folks who have their like kind of launch an L3 platforms. So maybe we can do like Steven and someone else as well. Hey everyone, wanted to give a big shout out to today's sponsor, Wormhole Foundation, stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. If you are like Santi and I and you play around on chain, you know how bad the cross-chain experience is today. Well, Wormhole has set out to solve that, powering cross-chain transfers for over 200 different multi-chain teams, including some of the best like Uniswap and Circle. So what does that mean for you, the Empire listener? This opens up a huge number of multi-chain use cases across DeFi, NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. By supporting over 30 different blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Sui, Solana, different ETH L2s, Ethereum, and a whole bunch more, that means you have now the most powerful interoperability platform at your fingertips. If you're a developer, you'll be excited to hear that Wormhole provides an extensive suite of tools and infrastructure so that you can securely build multi-chain applications. But don't just take our word for it, obviously. Wormhole Protocol leads the industry in all-time messages transferred with over 900 million cross-chain messages. 900 million, that is close to a billion, and that's a big number of messages. As a thank you, Wormhole Foundation is dropping exclusive NFTs. That's right. We got some exclusive NFTs for Empire listeners. Hit the link in the description to claim your unique Wormhole NFT today. This episode is brought to you by Monad. Monad's thesis is simple. The EVM is here to stay, similar to JavaScript and Web 2, but unfortunately, today's EVM lacks the high performance and the scalability that developers need to make certain applications possible. Monad addresses these concerns and these bottlenecks while preserving seamless EVM composability for application developers. There's a seamless transition to Monad as the Ethereum RPC API allows for really easy portability. And for developers, Monad can support 10,000 real transactions per second with their unique parallel execution environment. And of course, there's full compatibility with EVM bytecode. Monad's internal DevNet is live. Public testnet comes out soon. You can join Monad's journey in two ways. One, go follow them. They're on Twitter at Monad, M-O-N-A-D underscore XYZ. And also join the Monad Discord. It's discord.gg/Monad. Big thanks to Monad for sponsoring Empire. The last thing I'd say on this topic is like, I noticed that there was a lot of hate around Blast. There's the Munchables hack, and I think $62 or $63 million hack, and people were like, do you let the hack happen or do you roll back the chain? And then people were commenting saying, look, if Blast rolls back the chain, you'll see how centralized it really is, so they can't do that. And I would just remind people the difference between Blast and Base and Binance Smart Chain is slim to nothing. It is brand. And you don't have to take my, it's not my take for that. I think that folks at L2 Beat do a really good job of that. There's for anyone watching on YouTube, you can see it right here. But like you look at Base, so L2 Beat has these different stages and then different risks, right? So this is Base. They've got 3 out of 5 are red, 2 out of 5 are green. Same with Blast, stage 0, items missing for stage 1, they've got 3 X's. Proof system still under development? No. User withdrawals can be censored by the permissioned operators? No. Or yes. Upgrades executed by actors, et cetera, et cetera? Yes. So exact same thing. There's no difference between these two. So Yeah, yeah. I would just remind OP as well. So as actually as L2 Beat lays it out, the only folks who have moved into stage one, it's Arbitrum, DYDX, and ZK Sync here. So everyone else.
The biggest distinction there are fraud proofs.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think, yeah, I look, at some point, you know, Blast has been, Anatoly had a good tweet this week about, you know, the criticisms of Solana being higher hardware requirements, more centralized, and the fact that they've always been very explicit about that and upfront, whereas his criticism was exactly this with Ethereum. It's sort of, they haven't been upfront about this, about the L2s and how, you know, they don't have fraud proofs. If an L2 doesn't have fraud proof, it is, you're at risk. You're beholden to them. They have fraud proofs, but they have a centralized sequencer. The sequencer is largely irrelevant for security. It's just more value capture to a particular party. It's a centralized, but ultimately you can always revert back to the L1. You don't risk that. You don't have a fraud proof. It's no different than a multisig in terms of the actual impact, implication for the user. And look, I get it. Blast is in development. They're moving at a pretty fast pace. And yeah, in the roadmap, you have to build fraud proofs. Optimism has been around for what, the longest? Where are the fraud proofs? I will constantly, like, I, you know, I won't get tired of saying it. Now, someone said that, like, they built it, they've been, like, in development or in some early form. But I'm like, it's been a couple of years. I know it's difficult, but it's been a couple of years. Like, like, yeah, it's concerning, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not to just throw shade on one particular, it's just as a matter of principle, like, just fraud proofs are essential. Otherwise, it's a multisig. Like, if you're upfront about being a multisig, and at least, like, it's better to be very upfront. Let me ask you a question. If you were to survey all the users that have deployed into Optimism, would you think that they, like, if you ask them about fraud proofs, do you think that they would understand that? Do you think they'd understand that it's the implications?
I don't think they care.
But if you compare the percentage, if you ask the same question, like, what percentage of people that are deploying in a Blast would appreciate that it's a multisig? Probably higher.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of criticism in the launch. If they rephrase it, they came out of it. Look, it's not perfect, but you want to see that. Anyways, I'm not, like, just defending my bags. You talked about how Blast was being, like, you know, blasted. and put on, like, the, you know, pitchforks and whatever, but, like, you know, they've been upfront about the fact that it's a multisig. Like, I get it. At some point, if Blast has a chance to be successful, fraud proofs are essential. Essential.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, look, we're agreeing, right? I'm just saying, like, the decentralization narrative that most, you know, most of the L2s promote is, I mean, it's a, at this point in time, it's not true, right? A lot of them are just highly centralized, and, you know, some of the biggest ones haven't implemented fraud proofs, and yeah. We're agreeing.
And look, I don't want to be cynical. I'm just being, I'm just laying out, I understand that there's development to work.
I think fraud proofs did, things are, to defend them, I think they did implement fraud proofs on testnet recently.
I believe so. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. That's what I verified this. So, I've been told this by multiple people, especially at DAOs. So I may be speaking out of turn now, but I just generally think that I appreciate it. These things are hard to build. They take time. And I know there's a team, and there's teams that are devoted to figuring this stuff out. I don't want to imply that there's not. It's just, but the reality is, let's just call a spade a spade. That's the point that I'm making, that people have a way to focus too much on criticizing other projects, whether it's meme coins, whether it's an ETH killer, whether it's whatever. Like, focus, as a matter of principle, focus less on criticizing others and just internalize, do introspection, and figure out what you need to work on yourself. That applies to L2s and everything else in life. Like, you know, like, just don't throw stones if you have sinned.
like that story in the, whatever, the Bible. I'm not religious at all, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Let's pivot.
Let's pivot Echo. For sure.
Echo.xyz. Echo. Kobe's project.
Yeah.
You guys had a nice little thing. What's your company project? What are we calling it? Bid Club.
I'm also an Echo.
All right. Are they similar or different? So
Bid Club. No, they're different.
So Bid Club. Okay. I'll do your shill for you, which is, there's something on Twitter today. It said, announcing Bid Club's founding members. Bid Club is a membership based investment idea sharing platform for longer form theses around publicly listed cryptocurrencies. Now in closed beta, looking for our next cohort of members. Bid Club's founding members, Arthur from Defiance, Jason Choi, Avi Fellman, James, and Vincent from Modular Cap, great guys. Jason Cam, Andrew Kang, Kyle Samani, Santi, Daryl, Xerox Wangarian, and the last guy who I don't know, Tantai. So that's Bid Club. Then Kobe also announced something fairly recently, which is Echo.xyz. Mm-hmm. I think the best way to describe it is maybe like a crypto only like angel investment platform, or maybe like a crypto only angel list, maybe is the right way to describe it. But what are your thoughts? I'd love to hear the thesis for Bid Club, and then B, I'd love to hear like just your thoughts on Echo.
Yeah, so I'm involved in both. Full disclosure, I think both serve a clear purpose, and they're quite different. Your framework is, I think, correct. Echo is early stage, like an angel list, investing in startups. There are clubs, or I guess groups, and certain personalities that have a group. I sort of missed that line because I was too kind of lazy or tied up to connect my Twitter account and all this stuff. But anyways, there's some good syndicates that you can apply to and join. Larry from the blog, you have Ansem, you have Casey, you have multiple people, Will Price, just a bunch of people that are, I guess are known or good, have a good reputation being early stage investors that have had these groups and syndicates. So I think of it as angel list. Bid Club is differentiates in two forms. One, it's more of a discussion debate platform, like idea sharing, not so much like actionable. Like it's not like you're going to send money and fund directly on the platform. It's just meant to be like a place where you can curate a discussion. And there's analogies to these as like public markets, right? Like I forget the platform. Jason knows it's like stock tweets or whatever. Like there's platforms where people share, even conferences where people go to, and there's like hedge fund managers that talk about like pitch public ideas, and then it's a healthy debate. So I think about like Bid Club as a more of a debate club, and skewing exclusively to liquid, like projects that have launched. So a lot of what you'll see there now is, you know, there's a post about the thesis for WIF, you know. There's a thesis for Solana. There's a thesis for you name it, but it's only liquid tokens. So they're quite different in that sense.
So on Echo, do you like you can follow different? What's the problem that Echo is trying to solve? It's that a lot of the angel deals right now are very private and.
Yeah, it's trying to democratize access to early stage investing.
It's funny, in a way, ICOs, they really were the fairest option here.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Like ICOs with certain modifications, I think, would be the purest expression of just opening up access. I think you have, you know, tweaks and saying, like, in terms of just standardizing disclosures and, you know, but yeah, I don't disagree with that at all, actually. Kane and other people have been kind of vocal about like revisiting the idea of an ICO.
Yeah. What's your vision for Bid Club? Like, how involved are you?
And just one point, which ties into the discussion we're talking about, like fully diluted versus circulating. Like, ICOs had more of the tokens circulating out of the gate. Better price discovery.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, you hear these criticisms time and time again, like, you know, retail, quote unquote, not institutional investors can't invest in these projects because they maybe not fall under the accreditation, or even if they're not in the accreditation, they're not like invited to invest in these rounds. And so Yeah, I think Kobe's sort of taken that stance and wants to take a crack at it, which is, yeah, why I'm excited about, you know, yeah, exploring that. The thesis for Bit Club, I'm excited because I've, for a while now, have found public markets more intellectually engaging and fun than early stage. Even though I still do a lot of early stage, I'm thinking about my like public opportunities, like liquid tokens. And I just think that it's, I never thought I'd be like a quote unquote hedge fund guy. My background, my training has been in venture, cryptos both, obviously. But I think a lot of opportunities are in the public markets, like liquid tokens. I think it's an area that on a relative basis is probably underlooked by institutions. You know, there's some guys like the Modulo guys, Reflexive, Multicoins does some of this. Like some funds like have the a liquid strategy attached to them. But I think in the grand scheme of things, there's way too much emphasis from investors, institutional investors in the space and early stage opportunities, not so much in public markets. And I think there's an incredible amount of opportunities there that, you know, retail has access to. So, yeah, you know, the nice thing, there's like that joke, right? That the VC lives the best life. He gets to invest and wait 10 years to be proven correct or not in traditional venture. Crypto's earlier, right? Because you might've invested in Wormhole or Athena 6 months ago and now you have a token. So the market, you know, then and there you know, I guess it's much faster, but you know, I think public markets are really cool and more intellectually stimulating, at least for me, because you know, it's a bit more daunting, I guess. You invest in something, it goes down like 60%, 70% overnight. Like when I first invested in WIF, I think like it went down like 60%. Like woke up and I was like, okay, yeah, this is definitely a volatile thing. I was on this podcast being, you know, when it first hit $1, when it first hit $2, right? You could see me worked up. Like, what should I do? Right? It's already up a lot. Like, how should I manage that? And instead of running away from that, historically, I had run away from that because I now pay more attention to that. And I think it's like, even this experiment with trading meme coins, I funded like some random wallets, like just to, as experiments. They're no longer small experiments, but that process, I think, has allowed me to like just develop another muscle as an investor that it's less developed in venture. And I quite like that. I've really enjoyed that experience. And I think it will help serve me well, even for early stage investing, but also just to apply it. Like I have now a more growing desire to spend more and more time in liquids because I'm now just really, really convinced it's very overlooked. That's where I want to spend most of my, like said differently, if I were to start a fund today, like raise money, I would spend more than 50% of my time on liquid.
But how much
because of it's that way, it's way more scalable strategy. Like you could raise $1 billion yeah, today and deploy in liquid. Paradigm's now trying to raise 850. How much of that's going to go into privates? Like that's just not yeah, going to bode well for all.
But how much of that is a factor of where we're at in the cycle? Right, like the venture deals have gotten now pretty ridiculous. Yeah, like
true. Like they will certainly be able to deploy 850, maybe across two cycles. Like Multicoin today just announced like invested over $200 million in Wormhole. Yeah, you do four of those deals. You wouldn't, right, from a concentration standpoint. But you're right. You're starting to see now more and more the 200, the five. We're going to see $1 billion raise, right? So, I just think that historically, a lot of that capital has flown into privates that have a long duration. They carry a lot of risks, whether you want to think about them or not. Whereas public, I think, is way more scalable and more actionable. Like you can deploy over multiple billions of dollars into something like Solana on a risk-adjusted basis. Is it going to outperform most stuff? Probably. None of this financial, is just like as an example, hypothetical. Or some of the large, like the top 50 tokens by market cap, like they're over $1 billion, right? You can buy 5% of that token supply fairly easily and you know, run a fairly concentrated book and all liquid. You know, you don't have redemption necessarily risk or as much. You can be more tactical. Yeah. Maybe no one will give me money because they're like, no, most of your success has been in early stage, which is partially true. But yeah, no, I really, I really think it's an area that is overlooked. So when I met the modular guys, when I met Jason, how involved I am in Bit Club, Jason came to me, I think it was the first or second person he came to, and then we selected some of the other members in there. But we were very thoughtful around the people that are in there are typically guys that, you know, have their own fund managers, and they are vocal and invest in liquid stuff. That was a criteria. There was a lot of other people that could have fit that bill, but they were just not active in the public markets. And so liquid markets, I'd say. And so they're just not meant for the platform. So what we envision doing this is like token 2049 in Dubai is a little too close, but like sometime like maybe permissionless, or maybe some of these conferences where you have a SOAN type. SOAN conference is really cool. Like you have some of the best investors like Stan or Camilla go and they pitch their ideas. There's private dinners that hedge fund managers do, and like they kind of they have to come up with an idea and they can be picked apart, right? So that's I like that type of debate. And so I envisioned Bit Club taking that type of form, like online platform for very high caliber discussion on ideas, more curated, more sophisticated than crypto Twitter. And then a component of in-person, which you guys are experts on. We've talked about this, right? You know, layering it as a side event in some of your conferences would be pretty cool. Have, you know, local clubs where people can go to and learn about this stuff and, you know, debate. And a big part of this and where I've spent a lot of time with Jason is the disclosure component. Like, I'm always very uneasy. I think we don't get as many views as some other podcasts in crypto because we're not here telling you, we're not talking about prices as much. We've been spending 30 minutes on L3s. I mean, people are already snoozing at that point, right? They want an idea. They want, I need to buy, am I going to buy a wormhole? Yes or no? Am I going to buy, you know, Athena? Yes or no? People want to be spoon fed. I don't like to do that. You don't like to do that for obvious reasons. But I think there's a time and a place for that. And I'm hopeful that Bit Club is that.
Nice.
And that's cool. I'm looking forward to it because I hope that I can do that in a way that, you know, I'm probably still going to be cautious, but I hope that I can do that. And it encourages me to be structured and standardized. Like if you're going to pitch an idea, it has to follow a certain format. If you're ever selling, if you're ever doing stuff like, and so it's just nice to have that type of template, right? Because it's written. I think these things, ideas should be structured as memos, the same way that you would do it at a fund. Well documented, people can read about it and comment and see all the disclaimers and disclosures. Whereas in a podcast, you're going to miss some of that, right? And it's better to be in written form.
Cool. I like it. Let's do it at permissionless. Yeah. I think it's a good idea.
Let's do it. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the same way that we did that meetup, but like maybe just a meetup for Bit Club members that have been active in the platform. And
well,
I'm actually really excited to see some people.
We're doing 0x day. So like permissionless is 3 days, but there's day zero, which is 0x day. It's basically for Blockworks research subscribers. And we're going to bring a lot of the big allocators in the industry. And maybe we can combine forces in that way, but that's cool.
Yeah. That's cool. Investing is a social sport.
Yeah. And even more so in crypto. So, all right. There's one last piece of news, actually non-crypto, that I thought was cool this week, which was so there's a, the biggest prediction market company I think out there is not Polymarket. It's actually this thing called Kalshi. Like outside of like the kind of offshore Costa Rica ones, but there's one called Kalshi, and they've tried to do everything like right in the regulated way. They've raised some venture money. They've like waited to get the regulations, and actually they had
They're
a
based
really
in
cool
LA. They raised from A16Z, I think.
I think so. They had a really cool announcement today, which is that So the problem with prediction markets is that there's no liquidity. Like there's no real players and there's no liquidity. And like, they're just these like tiny, tiny, tiny markets. And liquidity begets liquidity, but same thing on the other side, right? So when you don't have liquidity, it gets tough. So
terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. So today actually, they announced that Susquehanna became Susquehanna is one of the biggest market makers in the world. Mm-hmm. Susquehanna became the first institutional market maker to commit to actually making markets on Kalshi. And there's this post from the founder, Tarek, which is, look, SIG, Susquehanna, I think probably Susquehanna Investment Group, has trades $2 trillion in yearly volume, one of the largest market makers in the world. First time in history that big institutional Wall Street market making firm is now committing to make markets on a prediction market platform. And actually the impact on this is on Kalshi, you used to only be able to trade 1,000 shares at a time. You can now trade 100,000 shares at a time. And actually in Susquehanna's announcement, they said, yeah, we're going to be making markets for everything from monetary policy swings to Taylor Swift's album performance. So I think it's great. That's I think it's really, really cool. And I think what's happening is they realize the demand that's going to be there for the presidential election.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have two thoughts on this. One, I was having I was skiing with a group of older folks, all American, last week, and
like all American skiers,
like they're like
they're all skiers, American. Like, I get it.
They're all American, and of course, politics always comes up at the table. Like, here we go. I said, like 20 minutes in, I was like savoring the comment. I'm like, guys, I just sent them the link. It's like, check this out. I sent them like the Polymarket, the politics page, and then they were like. They were like fascinated by it. They couldn't stop talking about the rest of the week. They're like, oh my god, they like, and I'm like, it adds just a lot of really good signal and just data, right? It's like a $100 million market. Like, stop pontificating. No one cares what you think, John or Joe the plumber. Look at the prediction market. Who's going to be the nominee? Like, they were talking about like who's going to be the nominee for Trump. I'm like, go look at the prediction market. It's not going to be Nate Silver, and it's not going to be CNN and all the political pundits that have gotten it wrong time and time again in the last couple elections. It's just been harder because it's voter apathy. The market, the country's more like polarized now, right? People are like afraid to tell you they're a Trump voter, they're secretly Trump voters, whatever. So anyways, prediction markets, I think, are probably going to be one of those things that are like, I just find it fascinating. And they're probably going to be the top three consumer app like crypto. So it's really cool to see. The other point I wanted to make around this was, yeah, this is just the page that I just sent people, and it's like, it's a huge hook.
There's $100 million on this, on Polymarket.
That's the main market. Yeah, it's, I think it's the largest. Yeah, so it's not small.
Yeah,
like who are you gonna trust, CNN pollsters or the prediction market that has 100 million behind it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that there's an interesting flavor now. Just, of course, we've got to finish the podcast where we ended it with meme coins, like Bowdoin and Trump. I think there, and full disclosure, I invested in a project just recently that is going to launch, that it takes a combination of what you're seeing with these meme coins that are representing outcomes in a way, signaling interest, right? There's a Trump meme coin. There's a Bowdoin meme coin that has wild swings when they come out, right? There's debates or whatever. Combine the two. Imagine, so the challenge of Polymarket and just prediction markets is you need a lot of liquidity, as you said. But if you combine like the meme coin aspect of it, like what you're seeing with Trump and Bowdoin, into a prediction market, anyone can create it, anyone can launch a meme coin of sorts, but like you attach more of the outcome component to it. I think you're gonna, the goal is to have not just one $100 million market. Like, why not create, attach onto memes have been incredibly good to scale and attract a lot of liquidity, combine that in a more prediction market type of platform. So that was my idea that I had. I'm kind of incubating this thing, but not so much. Like, I was involved in the kind of the idea generation of some elements of it. They came to me and I said, that's amazing, super impressive. And then we kind of like worked it through. So I'm hopeful it will work because I just want to see more
that's larger cool.
markets.
Yeah, I mean, the counter is that the only thing people like betting markets and prediction markets, people talk about them. I would love for a prediction market to take off. The counter is that every 4 years people talk about prediction markets, election years, and then it goes away.
Well, yeah, but like people were also want to maybe do
bet on,
you know, there's other stuff, right? Yeah, I mean the
sports. Will Taylor Swift tickets sell for more than $10,000? Yeah.
Discrete things. I mean, that's option markets in a way, right?
Yeah.
And derivatives. Yeah. That's the notional value that is like orders of magnitude more.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. It's interesting though. Like, suffice to say, I ended the discussion with these folks. I'm like, listen, guys, I probably will be, you look at Trump, two things like, who's going to win the election? I was like, oh, well, probably look at the Trump meme coin performance as a good indicator. An interest, but also like Trump had recently launched his SPAC, right? I was like, look at option volume expiring November, December, and January. Because if there's a huge spike, someone knows something, and Trump's going to win, right? The huge donor or whatever, like Bill Ackman's on the back end buying like all the way out of the money call options on the Trump SPAC. Like, if there's a huge spike, I'm like, yeah, I think Trump's going to win or whatever. Anyways, none of this political, legal, religious, or any financial advice for that matter. You shouldn't listen to this. You should post answers to the L3 discussion, which is more relevant to any of this.
Did you see the thing about Amazon? So Amazon, I don't have a content of the week this week, but, my story of the week is, so there's this. Amazon launched these stores like, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. And I remember going to one of the first ones in New York, let's call it in 2016 or 2017. And it, basically there are these employee-less stores where it was a full self-checkout store. It was crazy. You'd get a basket and you'd put in your tomato sauce and your pasta and your oranges and your bananas and your milk. And you just walk out of the store and it would automatically charge your like Amazon account, I think it was. And you had to have the Amazon account app on your phone. I was like, wow, this is the future. It just
did you use your palm or were you using
it? Wasn't your palm. You'd have your phone in your pocket.
Oh, you'd check and it'd open a gate.
And you'd walk in and it would like scan your phone in your pocket, kind of like walking through a subway turnstile. And I was like, man, this is the future of shopping. This is crazy. It was like so efficient. It turns out there's a story that came out this week. The way they were doing this is they had thousands of employees in India and they had video cameras, like hundreds of video cameras in each store that were just these tiny little video cameras. And so they were the people in India, you know, I'd take a tomato sauce off the shelf and put it in my grocery cart. And the person in India was just being like, tomato sauce, adding it to my cart in Amazon basically. And then charging oh, based on that. So it was just completely manual work. And I think they're shutting these stores down, and yeah, this, but
state of the AI market. Fake it till you make it, I guess.
Fake it till you make it. Yeah, you think crypto's bad. Yeah.
Cool. Well, last thing, content of the week. Well, two things. I did finish reading the Chris Dixon Read, Write, Own. Really good. That will become a staple of the book that I share with. Someone's asking me here. I'm getting skiing this week, and someone's saying, I'm really interested in crypto. What should I do? And historically, I've given them the Bitcoin Standard, which I think is like a very good book as an introduction by Safi.
Saifedean.
I'm going to butcher his last name. Saifedean. Yeah. Apologies. And now Chris's book. It's very good. Very articulate. So those two, I think, will become my staple.
Nice. That's great. I forgot to plug Empire newsletter launched this week. Shout out to the Blockworks news team. It was really good. Yeah. Shout out David and Casey and Catherine and McSweeney and everyone who worked on that. So if you're not subbed, go sub. Joseph, let's put a link at the top of the description. Last time you put it all the way at the bottom. Let's put it at the top. But yeah, thanks for listening, folks. Hope you guys are enjoying the newsletter. Yeah. Santi, enjoy the slopes.
Thank you, sir. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Looking forward to reading the comments in this one in particular.
God, I'm going to get shredded. Shouldn't have even hit record on this. All right. See you next week. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. Don't forget to claim your free Wormhole NFT exclusive to Empire listeners. Hit the link in the description of today's episode and fill out the form to claim your unique Wormhole NFT today.